This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, the Supreme Court strikes another blow against campaign finance limits. Also, Supreme Court justices, new dancing, what more could you ask for? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Cultured Gabfest, the TV recap website Television Without Pity has gone dark. What does this say about our need to preserve the culture of the internet? And then Noah's Ark gets a Hollywood makeover. And then the jerks shall inherit the earth in HBO's Dahl and M.
You're Emily's assistant, right?
Yeah.
I'm Edgar's.
Dolly, nice to meet you.
Hi.
Well, I mean, I'm not really Emily's assistant. I'm her best friend. I'm just here to help her while she does this film. It's just an excuse to hang out, really.
But she's paying you, right?
Yeah, sure.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. John Roberts and a conservative majority wiped out another set of campaign finance limits this week, finding that citizens should be allowed to give to as many different federal candidates as they want without an aggregate limit on their contributions. Is this a necessary protection under the First Amendment or another step in allowing the oligarchs to take control of politics? And then Arguendo is a new play that reenacts a famous 1991 Supreme Court case about nude dancers at the Kitty Cat Lounge. What can theater teach us about the Supreme Court? I'm joined in Washington today by John Dickerson, Slate's chief political correspondent. Hi, John.
Hello, David.
And also in Washington today is Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
In a 5-4 ruling on Wednesday, the Supreme Court unsurprisingly held that rich people had a right to give even more money to federal political candidates. The case, which is McCutcheon v. FEC, right? It's the V is against FEC, Emily? Yeah.
Yep.
Challenged the aggregate campaign contribution limits passed by Congress. The law had allowed direct contributions to any single candidate of no more than $5,200 in any cycle. That remains. But there had been a max to all candidates that you could give about $50,000, slightly less than $50,000 to all candidates. There's other money. You can go to party committees and so forth. We'll just not talk about that. Roberts Court said, halt. This is a restriction on free speech for people who want to spend lots of money. Let's say you want to give $1,776 to many, many different political candidates, as McCutcheon of Alabama wanted to do. You ought to be allowed to do it. That is your free speech right. This is not corrupting. So, Emily, what is the basis for John Roberts and his conservative colleagues on the court to find that this is these aggregate limits are a First Amendment violation?
Well, it's a great example of the genius of John Roberts at playing the long game. And the long game here starts even before he got on the court with Buckley versus Valeo. So that's the foundational decision in the 1970s that equated money with speech for the purposes of spending. So the idea was, because money is speech, you can't limit what candidates can spend. But Buckley said you can limit what people can contribute because of this countervailing problem of addressing corruption. And since then, the understanding of corruption has mostly been pretty recognizable and broad. The idea that we're worried about undue influence, worried about ingratiation, access, all the sort of smarmy but, you know, relatively intangible things that can completely screw up the political system. So then Citizens United comes along in 2010, and we mostly know that decision as allowing corporations and unions to give to independent political groups. They still can't give directly to candidates or the parties, but then they can do all this outside spending, and that unleashes this floodgate of money. It also had some language in it that could be read, and has now been read, to redefine corruption. So we're no longer talking about all of the, you know, favors that might go on that don't rise to the level of quid pro quo, defined essentially as bribery. That's really now the only kind of corruption that the court says Congress can regulate in the face of this hugely important First Amendment interest that rich people have to spend all their money. That's the pillar of this decision, which then essentially says, okay, well, once we've defined corruption in this narrow way, Congress had no basis for these aggregate limits. And Roberts, who Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote that the majority, well, it's really a plurality, but that doesn't matter because Justice Thomas is such a solid fifth vote, he would have gone even further. So essentially, it's the majority opinion. And what Roberts says is, this whole problem that Congress is trying to address of preventing an influx of money into the system is not really legitimate, because we don't care if rich people have so much more influence than everyone else. And secondly, Robert says, you know, the problem of circumvention of the base limits is not legitimate either. So what the court had said in Buckley in the 70s, because this we're talking about a election law that was passed way back in 1971 in the Watergate era, the court had said, you know, if we don't keep this aggregate limit in place, people are going to figure out a way around the $5,200 limit. Now that rationale is gone. And that's a big fight that Justice Breyer gets into Roberts in Breyer's dissent. But for the majority, that's where we are.
He said the aggregate limit is no longer, because there are other measures to keep that from happening.
There are other measures, but really, that Congress could enact other
Congress could enact measures that would prevent people from transferring money or from doing chicanery. So, John, this appears to benefit a very small group of very rich people. I mean, is that right? Is it essentially just going to help a very small group of very rich people who are disproportionately Republican? Or is there larger?
Well, I don't know. I think you could. You're right on the first part. So that if you care about global warming and you want to support only candidates who promote global warming, and we have such a person out there right now, it's going to help the rich on both sides. So it's going to help the rich on both sides. It's going to help pollsters and strategists and all the other people who do things that require spending a lot of money in campaigns. They are going to now have lots more money to pay them to do what they do. I mean, there's always. Campaigns are limited
I need to stop you here. The both sides thing just isn't the case. I mean, it's true. There are very rich Democrats who make contributions. Disproportionately, these are people who are giving to Republicans. So the base of this is why Republicans were wildly in support of this decision and Democrats are wildly opposed, is that there's a huge disparity among these very rich.
So it depends on the kind of money you're giving. So that if you're giving money, if you're giving unregulated money or essentially unregulated money to a super PAC, that's different than the money that we're talking about here.
Well, the question is it, right? I mean, you can
argue. One, you're disclosed and one, you're not.
Yes, it's different. It is. There's disclosure and accountability. And so there is an argument that this is better. If you think of the pie as like a fixed amount, which I don't think is true. But if you do, if you think, okay, the Sheldon Adelsons of the world have already anteed up, we're not going to add to their number, you can make an argument saying, well, better to give more of the money to the insiders, to the party people, the candidates. They're less crazy, radical, unaccountable than these outside spending.
That's just a completely preposterous perspective on this, because all the evidence that we have seen suggests that anytime you allow more money into politics, more money will go into politics, basically, because politics is underpriced.
No, it's not preposterous.
It's wrong.
No, it's not.
Yes, so, it is wrong. The value you get from political investment, if you're making a contribution, is a very good value. You get a lot of return, especially if you're rich. You can influence things which have an enormous payback for you in terms of, you know, help for your industry, protection from regulation, shifting regulations. And that's why every time we've given the chance for more money to flow into politics, more money flows into politics, whether it flows in directly through a front door of a contribution to a political candidate, or it flows in through side doors, which are these super PACs or other organizations that people can spend on. And I just don't think it is reasonable to say that now that people can give more money to parties, therefore they will give less money to these shadowy organizations. But the money to the shadowy organizations, I won't make you a bet on the show, John, the money to the shadowy organizations remains just where it is or goes up.
Okay, so here's the problem with this debate is that it's important to understand the different kinds of money and the different ways in which it acts. When we last had a conversation about this, you made me a similar bet, and you said everybody's going to write in with lots of examples of quid pro quo. One of the reasons we had this debate before is that I'd argued that if you're trying to convince John Roberts that the bad parts of money are all about quid pro quo, you're going to have a hard time doing it because there aren't a lot of examples of quid pro quo. And if that's the case you need to slay him, he's going to decide the way he ultimately came down and decided. So what happens is there's all this like massive indignation and money is – so you need to like pull apart the ways in which the money is incredibly corrupting in the system. But just like indignation, money is bad in all of its forms, I think is imprecise. And what happens is then you just get people being like emotional. What Emily was saying is really interesting, which is that there is a way in which if the political parties have more money, then their interest, John Boehner's interest, now if he gets to control a huge pot of money, is he can use that money as a lever of power to get legislation passed. Now, he may not have great things in mind when he wants to pass that legislation. But it is better if you're measuring two bad things. If you decide that money in politics is bad, which you may decide, it's important, I think, to distinguish between the two kinds of badness. So it's bad that John Boehner, it's maybe bad that John Boehner or Harry Reid has more power to get his way because he now has more money. So he can tell a member, do what I want, or you're not going to get money to go to your campaign. That is perhaps one kind of badness. A worse kind of badness, I would argue, is when a chemical company who has very specific narrow interests uses their money to support their very specific narrow interests.
And we don't even know that's happening.
Correct.
Because there's no disclosure. But,
correct. And so focusing on the lack of disclosure in the one case is conflating that with the other, I think, just mixes and messes things up. This plea for specificity and distinction is not to suggest that the one kind is great. It's just to make a distinction between the kind of influence that's now being protected, which is distinct from the other kind of influence. Because I think otherwise you don't know how to attack these ideas. But arguably, the John Boehner having more influence over his members or Harry Reid having more influence over their members is more in the category of kind of the wielding of power that's a part of politics as we understand it, as opposed to the super corrupting influence that we have when corporations pursue their
interests. John, I don't disagree with you at all. It's obviously the case that more public transparent donations to parties and that where the parties have more money to dole out to their candidates will give the parties relatively more power. I don't disagree with that. What I disagree with is the claim that this is a zero
finite sum
of money. There's still a huge amount of money.
That
vastly
wasn't Emily's
more
claim.
Is going into
that wasn't
the shadowy world, and it continues.
Right. But that wasn't Emily's
claim.
Continue
to go into the shadowy world.
Right.
It will continue
but
to go in the shadowy world.
I don't think anybody who's making that claim, and Emily certainly wasn't. The argument
that
was
that claim is out there. I mean, right now there are only 540 people or so who give up to the max, and the question is, are there lots of other people who are eager to join them and then go beyond?
Yeah.
You know, do lots of people want to be Sheldon Adelson on the right and Tom Steyer on the left? And will this additional route for those people where you can have direct influence bring in a lot more money? Or is this like a little tiny clique in American society that's, I mean, we only have 150,000 donors in the entire country. We are already talking about 0.1%. So then this additional question of how big the millionaire pot grows, we don't know the answer to that.
No, we don't. But I think we can be pretty safe in past practices in concluding a couple of things. One, lots more people are going to give as much as they can. The people who are going to get richest fastest are going to be the pollsters and strategists and those people, because campaigns start earlier and earlier, in part because you want to grab that first mover's advantage. And that means you need to raise more money to do all of the things you do, which is not just running ads on TV, but also hire pollsters and strategists and all of that. It's why spending on to win a congressional race or Senate race has doubled in the last roughly 10 years. So we can be pretty sure that, as John McCain says, money in politics is like water through cracks. It finds its way.
Right.
It's coming. But one thing I just want to say that's just really important about to this question of quid pro quo is that the way money works and I'm struck by this, it comes up more and more in reporting, is I was talking to somebody the other day about the Republican Party and how it was trying to reposition itself. And this person said, you know, I thought we should have had a big debate over Dodd-Frank as a way to kind of define the party as not in the pockets of the banks. And this person said, but in talking to members of Congress, they kept bringing up the amount of money they were getting from the banks. That anecdote has been in my ears for years and years and years. Now, that's not too dissimilar from the person who says, I can't vote for tax increases because Grover Norquist is going to kill me. It's not Grover's money that kills them. It's his ability to funnel the power of the people who support his point of view. That's a separate argument. We can have that debate.
But it's anti-majoritarian.
It's anti-majoritarian. And somebody, by virtue of the amount of money that they can donate and the money they can get into campaigns, has an incredible influence over the way these, in the real world, in the way these members talk on both the left and the right, they are stopped dead in their tracks by the money they get. It is an obsession, and the fear that it will go away in these campaigns that are increasingly expensive, the fear that that money will go away if they do the wrong thing on both the left and the right is absolutely paralyzing, and it's constant.
So why do you think that the outside group corruption is worse? I mean, the way I was thinking about this before you started talking was that, okay, the outside groups can be more extreme and radical, and if you believe that the Republican Party is not being held hostage by them already, you think, like, well, John Boehner better than Ted Cruz. And as long as the state political committee hasn't been taken over by the Tea Party, you'd rather have the insiders in control because they're relatively reasonable.
Right.
I mean, it seems to me like we're talking about two different flavors of corruption, and they're both awful.
My goal in life is to accept that we're talking about different flavors of corruption. I think you could order them all kinds of different ways. I think you could make arguments for all of them. I'm just happy to recognize that there's a very different kind of corruption, because I think one of the things that happens in the debate is when it doesn't get identified in the way it works, there is a loophole for people to say, well, there's no quid pro quo, so there's no issue here. But there is an issue, and there's an issue of whether there is, by virtue of the amount of money you donate, you just drown out the voices of everybody else.
Right.
And as a practical matter, in the way these campaigns work, money being the mother's milk of politics is the truest thing about politics, period.
Well, I, for one, am glad that the rich are getting their chance to have their full say.
Can we just, on that final point, there have been some stories about how the 1% feels like they're under assault. This is just another way in which they're doing just fine. They're going to be on both the left and the right. All kinds of new phone calls are going to be coming
But you're
to
so
the 1%.
Insensitive, John. People are going to be shaking them down. They're going to be,
I know,
you know,
they are going to be asked for money. You're right.
I mean,
you're
I'm really worried about them.
Oh, good point.
That's right. The assault is coming. I'm not saying they're not under pressure. They're under pressure from campaign finance directors at all the campaigns.
Coming up, nude dancing and the Supreme Court, two great tastes that go great together. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Arguendo is a play that has just opened here in Washington, D.C. after a very successful run in New York. It's going to travel elsewhere in the country. It is essentially a performance of a Supreme Court argument, a 1991 case about whether Indiana had the right to ban all nude erotic dancing at the Kitty Cat Lounge. The case is a doozy. The nine justices ended up producing, what, five different opinions. Ultimately, they upheld the right to ban nude dancing, but it was fascinating discussion about the First Amendment, about nudity laws, about the distinctions between erotic dancing and perhaps nudity. It appeared in a more artistic way. Emily consulted on the show. Emily and I saw it last night. John was supposed to see it but was unable to because of some intervention in his life. But it's a really interesting show. But I wanted to use this to discuss the Supreme Court as theater, or sort of what we can learn about the Supreme Court from seeing an argument acted out like this. So, Emily, you, of course, have been to the Supreme Court and seen argument many times, and now you've seen it done theatrically in this play. Is this a mirror to the Supreme Court? Is this actually what the Supreme Court is like?
It's incredibly closer to a mirror than you would ever think could work as theater. And when I first started talking to John Collins, the director of Elevator Repair Service, the theater group that's doing the play, and when I saw the early version workshopped, I thought, oh my God, this just can't succeed as theater. It's so boring. And there's all this discussion of abstruse case law. What did the Indiana Supreme Court say about what the First Amendment has to do with Indiana's nudity law? It goes on and on. There's like this really dense discussion about what tests they should be using. But now it has all of that in it because the Elevator Repair Service MO is to be very literal. These are the people that put on GATS, the 7-hour production of The Great Gatsby. They read, but there is all of this movement and humor and dancing that's been injected into the show in a way that really brings some of the words to life or buries the ones that are just too boring to really be able to stand. So I think it is, in a lot of ways, it's sort of a more fun example of what it's like to listen to argument.
When you actually go to the Supreme Court, so one thing this play conveys is the idea that the justices are really mentally grappling with this. That they are, I wouldn't say it's like flummoxment, but it's like some sense about, I mean, what I think we have on this show, which is like you're actually thinking about this issue. Is it, when you go to the Supreme Court, do you actually get the sense that the judges are thinking about these issues, or is it pure stagecraft? They know where they are and they are making rhetorical points.
They are really thinking it through aloud, and they do it in a variety of ways. They often come up with really difficult hypotheticals, which the lawyers then have to figure out on the spot how to answer in a way that will help their case rather than hurt their cases. the justices also are jostling with each other. They're kind of using the lawyers to talk to each other and test out their ideas. It's not to say that they go into every argument completely open-minded about the result. And in fact, argument rarely really matters in the outcome of a case. But the intellectual debating that's going on and the testing is super important. And as this case is an excellent illustration of, even if they know what they think the outcome should be, one of the best things about the Supreme Court and courts, appeals courts, is they have to write down a reason. And what you see with these multiple opinions is they couldn't agree on why the First Amendment didn't protect nude dancing. It actually turns out to be a hard question to answer.
So does that mean that you think, I came out of that thinking, gosh, they really need to televise these arguments. This is so much intellectual swordsmanship. It's so stimulating. But do you think, in fact, the very independence and free thought would be ruined if they were televised? So obviously the justices say this to themselves.
Their reasons for not televising arguments are completely self-serving. It's about wanting to maintain the Olympian status of the court. I guess you could say that has some kind of institutional value. But honestly, truly, I think they don't want to be recognized when they go to the grocery store. And that plus tradition and the fact that they get to make the decision. If they were not making the decision, there's no way these arguments wouldn't be televised. And it would not be cheapening. First of all, no one would watch, truly. There would be some sound bites, yes, but we already get audio of that, and we certainly get it through opinions and through the news. Some of them court that in their speeches as well. And it's just, you know, of course we would be richer for being able to watch.
I was in the grocery store the other day, and I saw the energy secretary, Ernie Moniz, who has this amazing haircut. That's how I ID'd him. I was like, oh, my God, that's the energy secretary. So I was telling my kids, not quietly enough, like, you guys have to see the energy secretary. It's an amazing haircut. And I turn around, and he's right there.
And were you embarrassed?
I was like, hey, Mr. Secretary.
But here's on cameras in the courtroom. The problem is there has not been an institution where cameras in the courtroom has improved the level of discourse, at least in Washington politics. I mean, it's ruined Senate confirmations more than they already – I mean, they're all
things – But that's a different animal.
But
those people are politicians.
No,
yes.
I know, but
– And that's the moment where the judge in the hot seat does have to watch
what
he or
she is
saying.
But maybe John's right, but it's like the we need more back rooms.
I don't think it would change.
No, I don't know that we need more back rooms. I just think that the level now – it's not like they're cloaked, as we've said. You can read what they've said and you can hear what they've said. I guess I don't know what the benefit is, and I worry about the risk, which is that basically televisions have
– How about just same-day audio? There was where there were a few same-day audio arguments. Now we're back to none. Same-day transcript would make me really happy. Now the transcripts are taking forever.
Well, that's stupid. Can we
close with one substantive question, which, Emily, you failed to answer for me, so I'm going to ask you again.
I know. This is going to be bad.
So – I'm pretty much a First Amendment absolutist, I realized, but my First Amendment absolutism has taken me first full circle, which is I came away from hearing about nude dancing thinking, yeah, if Indiana wants to ban public nudity, then nude dancing can be banned because nude dancing is not
speech.
Nude dancing is, as we can agree, it's expressive behavior in the way burning a flag is expressive behavior. It is not speech in the same way that money is not speech. So what I do not understand is how we've gotten to a situation where freedom of speech has come to encompass things which are manifestly not speech. Speech to me implies words, it implies argument, it implies language.
Okay, so writing counts even though it's not verbal speech? You would go that far?
I think writing counts in speech, yes. Yes.
That's good.
Freedom of the press. There's a freedom
of
the press, right?
Yes.
Freedom of the press is ensured in the same amendment.
Yes, but you could interpret that more narrowly.
Yeah, but press strongly implies
writing. But you don't want to go toward any kind of expressive performance so art, for example, visual art, photography,
again, but
dance.
Now that I think about the
music.
Press, I think something, again, freedom of the press, like something which is...
Art is not the press.
Well,
like
an image, like a cartoonish image.
I think what's so hard about this is the line drawing. The classic problem that judges grapple with is conduct versus speech. And you're basically saying that dancing, I think, is conduct, and the fact that it is sometimes or maybe always intended to convey some kind of expressive message doesn't matter. And so dancing should have no First Amendment protection. I think if we were talking about Swan Lake as opposed to, you know, nude dancing at the Kitty Cat Lounge, do you not want to include Swan Lake or opera?
Well,
I guess opera
has
sung
words.
So you would include the opera.
It's very hard to get the $20 bills in the Swan Lake costume. When
well, but
dancing.
See, this is the thing.
They're
is that
feathers get
they're
in the
jumping.
Way. Right, exactly.
In the end, usually these discussions start coming down to high art versus low art, and we can see why, you know, new dancers in the ballet would be an interesting interpretation that we would all glean some cultural insight from, but we think the women who are getting paid at the Kitty Cat Lounge don't deserve to dance nude. But to me, the idea that you would have no dancing in there just seems, I don't know. It seems like a very
well, just because you
crabbed.
Can have a law to stop dancing doesn't mean you will. It's presumably wouldn't hold up. I'm just saying I don't know why the,
you
First,
don't want
Amendment
the First Amendment
protects
to be invoked. Right,
dancing.
But then there is no other constitutional clear place for this challenge to go. I mean,
well, I don't know that there's a constitutional
right
to dance.
To dance. Right.
Oh, or brother, there is.
That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture GabFest starts right now.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture GabFest, Noah is a big-budget Hollywood Old Testament palooza from the director Darren Aronofsky. And then Dahl and M is the latest HBO meta-comedy. It stars Emily Mortimer as more or less herself, Emily Mortimer. And finally, Television Without Pity, the great TV website, has gone dark. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Stephen.
All right, well, Darren Aronofsky is the director of such movies as Pi, Requiem for a Dream, and Black Swan. God, meanwhile, is the author of The Heavens and the Earth, All Space, All Time as We Know Them, and by dictation to Moses, the Pentateuch, which includes within its book of Genesis the story of Noah. Now, thanks to the miracles of CGI, the miracles of the Old Testament can be brought together with A-list Hollywood directors and stars like Russell Crowe, who here plays the patriarch who receives the prophetic task of rebooting all humanity.
Our family has been chosen for a great task, to save the innocent.
The innocent?
The animals.
Why are they innocent?
Because they still live as they did in the garden.
Yes. And we need to save enough of them to start again.
But what of us?
I guess we get to start again, too, in a new and better world. But first, we have to build.
All right, well, Dana, I'm dying to hear what you have to say about this movie, whether your feelings about it were gusty, floody, you know, humanity eradicating, what exactly they were. But let me ask with a lead with an actual question, which is, isn't Darren Aronofsky, whatever else is true about the film, isn't he, with his hallucinatory style, the right guy to make such a movie?
He is and he isn't. I mean, he's certainly the right guy to ask the theological questions that this movie asks. And I was impressed to the degree to which it does ask theological questions. I'm still sorting out my feelings about it. Usually when we talk about a movie on the GabFest, I've already reviewed it. This time, because I was on vacation last week when this opened, I haven't. So I'm really just kind of still reacting to it in real time. I would say on the whole that this movie does not work. I don't think that it's good drama. I don't think it's particularly effective storytelling. It's got many ridiculable long stretches. But I was sort of impressed at its intellectual and philosophical ambitions, to tell you the truth. I mean, the way that Russell Crowe's character of Noah is drawn, the way he's written and the way Russell Crowe plays him, is just so un-Hollywood biblical epic. And it's so, you know, it's sort of affirmation of the void. And we can get into sort of how that plays out in the movie. But even though this movie does end with the traditional rainbow and dove with an olive branch that the Noah story always ends with, there is not a sense of hope for humanity running throughout this movie. And essentially, Russell Crowe's Noah is this anti-human figure who thinks that what God is asking for him is to eradicate all of humanity, including his own family, and that they should be the last, and that his youngest child will die, and that will be the end, and the earth will continue without humans. And Aronofsky sort of seems to be getting behind that, in a way, as a philosophical principle. So I guess I would say that in spite of the long, ludicrous stretches, that impressed me enough that I'm glad this movie exists.
Yeah, I had a similar response, which is that I'm glad I saw the movie, although I sympathized with the 9-year-old who walked out ahead of me saying, that was the longest, boringest movie I ever saw. the movie is unwieldy. But
who takes their 9-year-old to that movie also?
There were
good Lord.
So many kids in my screening and also so many people looking at things on their phone, which may also be a testament to that it felt like the longest, boringest movie that some people ever saw. But I think A.O. Scott had a line in his review that the most radical thing about the movie is its sincerity, and I thought that was really apt, that it really does seem to be puzzling through the question of what it meant for God to want to eradicate all of mankind, and strains of this adaptation that play as an environmental parable for today. There's a class of very metropolitan, urban, mechanically, technologically inclined people who have robbed the earth of its resources and turned it into a barren, treeless wasteland, who now have turned upon each other and are eating babies and raping women in the street and totally reprehensible and have weird beards, and they all need to die so that Noah and his more normal noble beard can move forward or something.
But there's also several scenes of mourning for the innocents that are left behind. So there's a real question as to whether it is actually the worthy who have survived or just the most fanatical.
That's funny you should say that, Dana, because what I was going to say to Julia is that was precisely my problem with the movie, was how stacked the deck appeared to me to be. I mean, it is a huge peculiarity that the two major religious traditions of the entire globe not only have a creation myth in which Adam and Eve are placed in, you know, the Garden of Eden and they taste of the fruit of knowledge and are fallen and must be redeemed and on and on and on. Well, if you're a Christian, you believe that they are eventually redeemed. If you're Jewish, you don't, but anyway, whatever. But that, as an add-on to that, the entirety of their progeny is completely tabula rasa'd by God, right, with the exception of this one family grouping. And the Noah story really, in that sense, is extraordinary. And I thought it would have made a much more interesting film, even in Hollywood terms, if you had felt more strongly that, in fact, what humanity had created was, by humanity's terms, quite beautiful and enchanting and advanced and industrial, and instead it's this kind of post-apocalyptic, mad. I mean, like, literally, they've created a hell on earth, and we deserve these floods to come. You make a much more intensely Old Testament and, you know, pardon the phrase, existential movie if you put Noah in the situation of Abraham, which is getting a direct order from God to do something that by human standards seems completely irrational. It seems to be evidence only of the most jealous creator and awful creator. And, you know, this is the nature of the Old Testament. It's the nature of Job. It's the nature of Abraham being told to kill his son. I thought the deck was so stacked, you couldn't wait for the flood to come along and completely wipe the face of the earth clean. And then the other thing I'll say is I didn't like the movie at all as a film. The story of Noah is powerful but short. It's bereft of many details. And to plump it up into a 2.5-hour Hollywood epic, you have to put in a lot of nonsense. I found the movie completely exhausting, and I was done with it after 15 minutes.
To your point, Steve, about how the movie would have been strengthened if it had had more ambiguity, I think that's really true. And I think if the human society that was being obliterated had been made more appealing and beautiful, that would have strengthened the movie. I also felt it was an incredible, unspeakable weakness for a $140 million Hollywood movie to tell the story of Noah's Ark and do such a job with the animals.
Hear, hear.
The
yes,
animals.
Let's talk about the animals.
I mean, this movie basically should have just been like Winged Migration. Like, they should have gotten the people who did the Blue Earth series to film actual animals. The whole point of it, the whole question is God's creation more perfect with or without human intervention? So it seems like you need to spend some time appreciating the beauty and wonder of God's creation. And then when the animals enter the ark, you see them in big swarms and flurries and rushing movement. I mean, they're almost like water themselves. They come kind of in cascading streams into the ark. You don't spot individual ones. There's one moment where like an elephant-esque animal falls into hibernation with a little child's book type smile on its face. But apart from that, you don't have any sense of the pairs of animals as individuals or
their
specific
beauty.
Well, that's
because Jennifer Connelly, who plays Noah's wife, puts them all to sleep with this magical smoke sensor that I guess exists in the past, where you can just walk through the hold of the ship swaying this church-like sensor and all the animals cozily fall asleep for the rest of the movie. I completely agree. I actually was sort of thrilled by some of those scenes where they streamed onto the ark, especially when the snakes all come and they're all kind of, people are freaked out that they have to transport all these serpents. But yeah, once they get on the ark, there is nothing done with them. It literally is as if the screenwriter just decided to shut them down so we don't have to worry about animating them anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there just could have been so much more drama there. I mean, that was another charming moment in the movie, was when the snakes all come, Jennifer. First, the birds come, and everyone's like, oh, birds, beautiful flight, hooray. Although, it starts on a photo of, like, two doves plunging about a stream in the way that you would expect egrets to. I mean, it set off some, like, bad birding bells.
Ornithological bad juju.
Yeah. And then flying, it's like, I saw Winged Migration. I know what it looks like to bee in the sky behind a bird, somewhat miraculously, because film has moved to the point where we can actually shoot that, and those birds look terrible. So the birds come first, charmingly, and then the snakes come, and Jennifer Connelly is like, ooh, the snakes are coming too, and it's like a little bit of a funny
right. Like, do we have to embrace God's creation to this degree?
But like, that would have been nice. Like, some of God's if there had been ambivalence about God's creation,
right.
As well,
worms,
the bugs, or if we'd shown some of the animals fighting or scrapping with each other, and some of the brutality and violence there. I mean, it is a genuine question. Like, is human just another animal who would dominates the food chain?
Which is a question the movie asks at the beginning. In the first 20 minutes, there's a lot of talk about the animals are innocent and we have to protect the animals and they're vegetarians. There's a part of this movie that's sort of a brief for vegetarianism with this idea that if you eat meat, you know, you're going to become like the evil descendants of Cain. Yeah, all that was a lost opportunity, as was the opportunity to create an alternate bestiary. You know, if you're going to imagine the feathered dog at the beginning, I mean, you could have put all kinds of crazy imaginary animals on the ark and it could have been wonderful and whimsical, but that was all.
Yeah, and I read somewhere that they didn't use any animals in the filming of the movie, which I think may have been a contributor to how shoddy the CGI looked. And I wondered if it was like a philosophical choice that you couldn't make a movie about how important it was not to exploit the earth for its animals, and then in the making of that movie exploit the earth's animals in an effort to make the movie seem really beautiful and sell a lot of popcorn.
Right, and suffer a PR disaster if one of them dies in the filming of the
But
of the
whatever,
movie.
You know, whatever. I would have rather had that hypocrisy in a better movie myself.
I know, ridiculous. All right, can I get a witness? Have we slagged on this movie enough? Can we move on?
I think it's been about 40 days and 40 nights, so.
I think so. All right, well, the movie is Noah. We didn't like it. It's directed by Darren Aronofsky. It stars Russell Crowe and Jennifer Connelly. You should go see it. If you think we're completely wrong, come and slag on us for 40 days and 40 nights. Coming up is HBO's Dahl and M, the latest trend in jerk television. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/GabFest. And please, while you're there, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/GabFest. All right, moving on. Dahl and M is a British comedy import now airing on HBO in a 6-episode run. It might better be called a meta-comedy, as it stars Emily Mortimer as a movie star named Emily Mortimer and Dolly Wells as her best friend named Dolly Wells. You get the picture. After a miserable breakup, Dolly goes to work as Emily's personal assistant, and what unfolds is a kind of queasy verite exercise in, is what I'm watching real or a lark? Dan, I'm very curious to know what you thought of it. Did you think it was breaking new ground, or have we seen a lot of this before?
Right. Well, in many ways, it is not breaking new ground in a way that's somewhat disappointing. I mean, it does continue in the vein of Entourage or so many other, I mean, name them, you know, satires, sort of mild satires of Hollywood that also want you to sort of enjoy the pleasures and perks of the vicarious lifestyle of someone in Hollywood. So it has that element. It doesn't function as much on envy, as you say, the way Entourage does, as much as on a sort of cringe comedy. I guess I liked it more than I thought for how slight it is, but it is very, very slight. I just felt that it was a bit underwritten. I mean, I love that improvisation is used in the construction of stories, but I feel like a few things that we've talked about lately, including this and Broad City, the sketch comedy, which is also about two young women who are friends, there's a stage of writing that hasn't been completed yet. It feels like a draft being acted rather than an actual script.
All right. Well, I'm going to tell you why I was inclined to detest the show and why I actually ended up quite liking it. I like the show, and the reason I like it is I believe in this friendship. The friendship strikes me as completely convincing. It's rooted in their own actual friendship. And the dynamic that occurs between two very old friends, one of whom becomes either very wealthy or very famous, to me is utterly fascinating because it's happened to me now, and one of my oldest and closest friends has become richer than God. And all I can say is that even though these are English women, and the last time I checked, he and I are a couple, you know, white guys from America, they are getting something very real about, you know, one person passes through this membrane and becomes fame and money in the modern world, just turn someone, a commoner, into a completely uncommoner, into a completely different kind of being. It just is a fact of modern life. At the same time, you possess a unique status vis-a-vis another person, whether they become famous or rich or not, if you're their oldest and closest friend, and these people are virtually sisters. And what happens when one of them passes through that membrane, and what happens to that friendship, and what happens to them as individuals, to me, actually is a subject of appropriate subject and a compelling subject for a comedy of manners. And I think that they've nailed that part of it without overdoing it. I think it's not thickly written in a way, Dana, but I think it's sharply written, and I really appreciated it.
I would agree with that. It is sharp but not thick. I would appreciate a little bit more thematic density, maybe. It feels a little bit low stakes, whether, you know, Dahl and M's apparently still invulnerable friendship is going to suffer more slights each week or not. So I'm not exactly sure how this will take turns into bigger drama or if it will.
Yeah, they both are oblivious to their own flaws in ways that end up causing them to make fools of themselves in various ways.
I guess in the sense
be jerks.
In the sense that this does recall that what Wilda Paskin of Slate called jerk TV tradition, which includes Enlightened and Veep, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Veep, and other kind of negative female characters, that's where I think the thick writing needs to come in. I mean, I don't think it's quite enough for us to feel this gentle, bemused tolerance toward them. I feel like there needs to be more of a density of development in order for us to hate them satisfyingly and love them at the same time.
I disagree with you there, Dana. I think Emily Mortimer shouldn't be what Susan Sarandon is in that second episode, which is this way too broadly written caricature. And she shouldn't be Ricky Gervais in the original Office. She shouldn't be this person for whom the, you know, discrepancy between how she perceives herself and how we and everyone else perceive her is massive, and then the comedy is generated from that. This is way subtler than that, but I think truer, which is that this is an essentially decent, sensitive human being who now, according to the dictates of Hollywood, is being treated like a miniature queen. She's become, and this does happen, like people become imperial within their own pond, and they become conscious of how big the pond is as well. And it's going to change you. It may not warp you or destroy you in some huge Darren Aronofsky bring on the floods of, you know, eternity way, but it will shift you, and it will shift the most important relationships in your life. And it seemed to me exactly that subtlety of register, you know, the little Geiger counter that this show takes to these changes. It shouldn't be any broader. I'm glad that it's not a broad comedy.
I hear you on that. I think in a way what it's showcasing is the distance between one's current self and one's past selves, and the oldness, the age of their friendship helps show that up, helps set that off, helps her realize the friction between her current self and her past self, the Emily Mortimer character. And that's part of what gives the show its interest.
Let me take that as an occasion to point out quickly the other thing that I love about the show, which is it does seem to me a somewhat nuanced commentary on the winner-take-all society. These two young women grow up in England, virtually indistinguishable from one another. They're both middle class, intelligent, attractive white chicks. And one of them just happens to have the right kind of talent or the right kind of look, and she becomes famous. And she suddenly, the world rushes toward her in this bottomlessly affirming way, and it makes no such motion in the direction of the other. And so we're meant to see that the sorority between them is intimate, but the gulf between them is also immense. And that's a social commentary. It's not just a personal commentary. It's something about what the world now does to recognize certain kinds of people and ignore others. And it just seems to me that's hitting some interesting nail that I didn't quite know was there right on the head. All right, well, the show is called Dahl and M. It's on HBO. It's only a 6-episode run. It's not a big waste of your time. If you want to check it out, tell us what you thought of it. Come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, well, moving on. When Sarah Bunting and Tara Ariano started dissecting episodes of Dawson's Creek online back in the 1990s, they probably did not have a revolution in mind. The resultant website, which eventually became known as Television Without Pity, has popularized the recap, a fanboy and fangirl format now deployed across the internet and elsewhere. The revolution they effected has been so successful to the point that when it was announced this past week that the site was going dark, New York Magazine decried the disappearance of not only the website, but the archives as well, as a weird spiritual crime against pop culture. Dana, other than myself being a weird spiritual crime against pop culture, I don't have, I must admit, much of a connection to this topic, though I did find the New York, I want to say very clearly, I thought the New York Magazine post written about it was beautifully written. But anyway, I don't have much of a connection to this topic other than your enthusiasm for it, so I'd love it if you took it from here. Tell us what the website meant to you and what its going away means to you.
I guess seeing that Television Without Pity is over, it's being shuttered, and its archives are, for the most part, disappearing into the ether just made me feel sort of nostalgic and sort of old, because it kept on being paraded that this was an example of Web 1.0, whatever that means. I don't know when the web started or when we're at Web 0 exactly, but I guess Web 1.0 is something I'm also a relic of. And at the time that this blog was starting to take off and get big, or blog would not be the word for it, this site, I had my own personal blog, as, you know, many of my friends who are now professional writers did. And it was just sort of a, I don't know, what I think of as sort of a fun guerrilla period of self-publishing, when it was actually sort of possible to get read as a self-published person, which is exactly what Tara Ariano and Sarah Bunting did, obviously, sort of turned their own fan obsessions into this huge, rich archive of television arcana. And that really is what it used to be. I mean, I sort of think of it less as a recap site than as a place for people to stretch their writing into crazy directions. And when you got somebody on Television Without Pity who recapped a show well, you could enjoy and love those recaps completely independently of whether you cared anything about the show. But just because that person was pursuing, you know, their own obsessions and really having room to stretch, their recaps were absurdly long, pages after pages after pages. It would be, I don't know, a couple thousand, maybe 3,000 words sometimes on a single episode.
It was often 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 pages that you had to click next and then wait for it to load at 2001 internet speeds.
And you had to wait a few days for them to appear, too. Remember, there'd be the mini recap right after the show aired. There'd be a couple paragraphs, and essentially the person was putting in a placeholder saying, I'm working on it, I'm working on it, and then you'd sort of wait for them to take their time. It would never happen now that you would wait, you know, up to, I don't know, 4 days, a week, until the next show was about to air before you would read the recaps. In particular, I remember this woman, Alex Richmond. I have no idea what else she's written since then or what happened to her, but she recapped Sex and the City for Television Without Pity. Not a show that I was particularly connected to at the time. I watched it occasionally. I sort of hate-watched it. But man, her recaps were hilarious. They just had their own voice. They were dead on. They got exactly what was ridiculous and also what was wonderful about the show, and they were so much fun to read. So the fact that that stuff is disappearing in a way makes me the saddest of all. I don't really care whether Television Without Pity continues to exist, because it's not what it used to be. The creators have left and there's recaps everywhere. So that has long been dead. But the idea that we're sort of eating our own internet culture in this way, and that NBC Universal, which owns the site, gets to decide what happens to all the archives, that makes me worry about the preservation of culture in the internet era.
Yeah, it struck me reading about the demise of the site, which I also have fond memories of, that the Museum of Television and Radio or the Paley Center, or maybe those two things have merged into one these days, but that some cultural entity devoted to the preservation of television should inveigle NBC Universal, get those archives and preserve them. It's in terms of kind of the evolution of internet vernacular television criticism, it's a huge treasure trove of gems and a real turning point, I think, in how the internet enabled us to enact with culture, and particularly television culture, in new and fresh ways.
All right. Well, explain a little bit to someone who's not a descendant of Television Without Pity, what is the appeal of the recap? I mean, why has this become such a big thing? I don't understand it. Is it generational?
Well, I think there's a couple factors in play here. One, I think, does have to do with the time shiftiness of television these days. The friend who turned me on to Television Without Pity, back when it was still called Mighty Big TV, is also my first friend with a TiVo. So it was the avant-garde of television watchers who were moving towards this new way of television that in my life at least led me to find this community. And, you know, she would watch shows whenever she wanted to because they were time-shifted, which seemed hugely novel at the time because we didn't all have DVRs. And then once you watched it at your time-shifted time, you could go onto the internet and find a whole other community of people who had also watched it. So instead of watching the show when it aired on broadcast and then chatting about it with your friends on your couch, or, you know, in the classic water cooler moment the next morning because everybody watched the Newhart finale or whatever at the office, you could find this online instead and find maybe nobody at your office liked Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but a ton of people online did, and you could go on there and check out what other interesting, smart people had to say about it, both the recappers and then the many, many commenters on each recap.
All right. Well, the piece that got us interested in addition to Dana's passion for the website was How Television Without Pity Shaped Pop Culture by Margaret Lyons. I think it's a great recap of what that website was. Check it out. All right. Well, now's the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
My endorsement is actually related to the Television Without Pity conversation. I was tweeting yesterday about the sadness of Television Without Pity's archives disappearing in particular, and I actually posted a link to those Alex Richmond Sex and the City recaps and was saying, it's so sad that these are going to disappear. Everyone go read them while you can. And somebody popped up and said, you know, if you feel that way, you should donate to the Wayback Machine, which was a very good piece of advice, and I think I'm going to do that, and I want to endorse that our listeners do that as well. So the Wayback Machine is this vast attempt to preserve internet culture and to preserve the internet. And I think insofar as it's able to do so, you know, in terms of rights with whatever organizations own the material. It tries to just keep everything that's ever existed on the internet, or actually even before. There's some old radio programs and things on there from, you know, pre-television days even. It's a place that essentially popular culture is being preserved. And it's a nonprofit that you can donate to. And if you go to archive.org, you can find your way around their vast, labyrinthine, amazing archives and also see a place to donate. And I particularly recommend exploring the old radio, actually. It's really fun. When you're done looking at Television Without Pity archives, which will take you 1,000 millennia, then you can go over and listen to things like The Shadow Knows, you know, or the Orson Welles War of the Worlds and old radio. It's all just really, really fun to dive into and never come out again.
Oh, that is cool. All right, Julia Turner, what do you have?
Well, because I'm a Philistine robot at the bottom of a vast churning sea, I will recommend for people who don't want a subtle emotional take on the moral depredations of Hollywood and fame, a slightly zingier, poppier, broader version of the show, which is Episodes on Showtime. Did we discuss Episodes on the show?
Is that the Ricky Gervais Hollywood?
No. It's the one that stars Matt LeBlanc as Matt LeBlanc and a British couple of screenwriters who come to Hollywood to write a show that stars him and get completely flummoxed and corrupted and befuddled by Hollywood and all its ways in the process. And it's been on Showtime for a couple of seasons, and I'm not a completist of the show, but I find it very charming. And it plays at similar angles of British people arrive in sunny L.A. and pastily try to live moral lives with only modest success. But it has a lot of verve and some great supporting performances. So I recommend that people check it out. That's Episodes on Showtime.
Mm, that's cool. All right, well, so...
that was not convincing.
I am going to boot that up as soon as we finish recording. So it's, you know, I'm not giving away any huge trade secrets here, but we do pre-record the show. It's April Fool's Day. I'm going to endorse a song I heard this morning on the radio completely randomly. Never heard it before. It's from Young, Gifted, and Black by Aretha Franklin, the Transcendent album, but I just don't remember this cut. It's called April Fools. I believe it's written by Burt Bacharach, and it's classic Bacharach and classic Aretha Franklin. It's an amazing, amazing song, and I think that's our show. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Volo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Scheckman. And the executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week. In an April dream, once you can.